call the meeting to order. Welcome, everybody. Looks like we have a quorum. Did everybody get a chance to look at the minutes, review them? Do I have a
Dave
motion?
Dave, I move to approve.
Thank you, David.
Tomasi, second.
Second. Any further discussion? All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Okay, first up, staff reports, financial progress reports. Jason Segedy.
I just have to get it ready here. Thanks. Carrie had my back on that. Well, good afternoon, everybody. Financial progress report is attachment 3A. This one takes us through February 28th, so we are well into the third quarter of the fiscal year, which ends on June 30th. At this point, we've expended 69% of our fiscal 2015 budget, which is just about exactly where we should be at this time of year. And no problems to report. We're on track budget-wise, and would ask for your approval of the financial progress report as submitted.
Hey, White, move to approve.
Second.
Second.
Any further discussion? All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Technical progress report, Curtis.
Thank you. I'll try to be brief because I know we have a pretty big meeting. So on the federal level, we've got 74 days until the MAP 21 expires. Currently, there hasn't really been a whole lot of movement on any of the issues, including, say, a gas tax increase, like what we'll be discussing later today. This is our first TAC where we don't have a CIC meeting afterwards because we've gone to that new quarterly schedule for the CIC. So our next CIC meeting is going to be April 30th, which we'll talk about a myriad of issues, which hopefully will continue to increase turnout. We'll see some positive response from that. What you're going to see today a lot of are some of the first inputs into our 2040 regional transportation plan. Some of the things the staff's going to be working on after these documents get approved is we're going to be looking at the existing congestion, redoing that report, as well as doing a new bike and ped plan, and also really those, and I think eventually getting into the freight plan later this year. So as we move through the planning process, looking at 2017 as the year, calendar year, when our next plan is due, this is when we start to create those inputs for your review, and that will influence the recommendations of the plan. If there are any other questions or any questions.
All right, thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
Hey, Matt's federal funds report. This is attachment 3C, Victor.
Thank you. Looking at our table, as you can see, there's a projects that have been moved out from their groupings for each of the fiscal years. And the reason why this was done, we have to financially constrain the TIP, which we're working on right now. So we don't have enough funds, so we have to move those projects out to get more in balance. If you look on the second page, the balances for each of the individual fiscal years, you see that they're still negatives. So we do have to do a little bit more moving of projects so that each one of those years, the new TIP covers 16 through 19, so each one of those individual years will not have a negative in them. So we actually made some of those moves last night so that we'll be good for what the federal measure for as far as the TIP financial constraint. One other thing I wanted to mention, the TAC TIP subcommittee had a meeting last week. We talked extensively about the main issue we're facing now, which is over programming. We've contacted five or six different MPOs in Ohio to try to trade funds with for next fiscal year, so we don't have enough. In the past, it would be easy, just make a phone call, they would say yes, and we'd write up an MOU and have it done within a month or so. Well, most of the MPOs didn't have the funds, and the ones that did, they're not willing to make any trades this early. So they said, come back in about 6 months and we'll talk again. So at this point, we don't have, and we also tried other agencies, the County Engineers Association of Ohio, So we did all we could in trying to train some funds now for 16, but we weren't able to do that. And part of that is because the MPOs were all on a carry-forward policy that ODOT instituted, so everybody's spending now their balances more than they have in the past. So it's getting more difficult to trade funds. But anyhow, it still might be a possibility in about 6 months to get some funds to fund all the projects that we had originally in 2016. So that was the main issue that we talked about in the subcommittee. We did also talk about it a little bit. So we're not sure if we're going to have enough money, so the subcommittee will meet like midway through fiscal year 16, see where we're at, and see what projects are left, how much money we have. And then we'll go from there to see what projects could maybe be moved to the next fiscal year and what we can do. And then we also talked a little bit about the 15% increase. We're about $7 million or so short in 16. If all those projects that were originally programmed are still in 16, that would be, I believe it was about a $2.5 million. But that would be based off of $16 million, which is our STP and TA projects. Be about $2.5 million worth of project cost increase that we'd also have to look for. So the original discussion on this is we're still going to try to do the 15% increase, but we'll see how that goes as we get nearer to 16. And that's all I have on this item.
Okay, we'll move on to old business, item 4, Victor.
Thank you. So back in January, we presented the first draft of the project list. 2016 and 2019 TIP. There's been some changes in that, mainly in our projects to balance the TIP. We had to move some projects around. And that's reflected here in the second draft. ODOT had some updates. Those have been changed too. So again, just take a look at the projects in here, especially your projects, make sure they're in there and the information is correct. But keeping in mind that we did move some of these back. So we're getting one last draft from ODOT, I think it's tomorrow, and we're going to compare that one more time with the list we got here, and then that will be the list that's going to be presented at the public involvement meeting and period. It's a two-week public involvement period starting March 30th through April 10th, and we're going to have a meeting on April 8th in the middle of that time period. So once it goes through the public involvement period, the TIP then will come back to this committee and the policy committee in May for final approval. And then it'll become active starting July 1st.
Okay. Do we have a, first of all, any questions on that for Victor? Okay. Do we have a motion to approve the second draft projects list?
Anybody move to approve?
Second?
More second?
Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Okay, new business, public participation plan. Krista?
Hi, thank you. This is attachment 5A. The 2015 public participation plan is an update to the 2012 plan, and as Curtis mentioned, this will guide the upcoming regional transportation plan. The plan addresses how the public can become involved in the transportation planning process, and then also how they can access information, records, our meeting minutes, all the reports we put out. The plan also addresses how AMATS is recognizing and engaging the growing needs of different groups and unique populations, kind of through the demographics, some of the Latino and Hispanic groups in particular. We are also continuing to build on social media and our web presence. It's something we've done a lot in the past year, and we're continuing to look at new ways to do that. We're also looking at new engagement strategies, such as the Better Block. The bike and brainstorms have been really popular, and we're building on those. And also, Jane's Walk is another thing that's ramping up and continues to expand. So looking at different ways to outreach to different groups and become more involved in communities on the ground. We did have one technical issue in posting to the website. We had the brand new website go up, and then we had an issue with the file size. So it got posted one day late on February 11th. This makes the 45-day public comment period on next Friday, March 27th. So we are asking for approval for the plan effective next Friday, March 27th. And then any comments we get from now until that date, we will the staff will consider, and then we'll bring back to you guys for consideration and incorporate them as needed. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and we are asking for a motion for approval.
Do you have any motion to approve effective at 8:30?
March 27th?
March 27th.
Do we have a second?
Second.
That was Amy got there first.
Now,
any further questions or comments? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, motion carries. Good job with that. That's a nice new addition. Okay. Item 5B, AMAT's planning data forecast. Nate.
Good afternoon, everyone. The AMAT's planning data forecast is a large-scale data gathering and projection process that AMAT's goes through periodically, and the draft in attachment 5 is our latest effort at that. Through this process, there are 35 different planning areas, each of which have some form of impact on local traffic that we have project using a base year 2010. And we do that because that's when a lot of real reliable census data is available. And we project it through the upcoming plan year, which will be 2040, so for a 30-year period. The primary purpose of projecting this data is to upload it into our regional traffic model, which is what we use to predict future traffic volume, congestion issues, and air quality analyses that we do. And as a secondary purpose, we use this for is to just kind of gain some general planning insight. Not all these we look at in great depth, but some we do. So there are 35 variables total. 25 of those are different employment categories that we examine. And there are a few that we use pretty regularly in a lot of our planning efforts that include population, employment, and median household income to determine where low-income areas are and whatnot. And some other variables that are part of this process that we don't really use a whole lot in other ways are things like the inventory of hotel rooms around the AMAPS region and school enrollment and things like that. These are all just necessary inputs into the regional traffic model that we use for the area. Of those 35 different variables, there are a lot of different methodologies used to get background data to our projections. We have to use a lot of different data sources, and they just have different characteristics. So the report details the methodology that we use to forecast each one through 2040. And the majority of that data comes from the U.S. Census Bureau. There's a couple different tools that they have and different data sources within that help out with different ones. So that's where most of the data comes from. Population is a kind of a special variable. We are constrained by the Ohio Department of Development Services. They project populations at the county level through various years, and to be consistent with their figures, we have to match theirs, even if we come out a little bit higher. Sometimes we've got to tone them down a little bit so that we have consistency across the state. That also goes into our model. ODOT helps a lot with our traffic modeling, and we just want to be consistent across the board with that. So that's kind of a special feature of that particular variable. For the most part, especially in regards to the employment, we use the linear regression analysis, but as we said, a lot of it, there's just a lot of different methodologies and they're kind of detailed within the analysis. Some of the limitations of this whole planning process is that to be able to project things, we gather a lot of previous years, like recent history data from the census and these things. And when you've got a 30-year planning horizon, like one recent fluctuation in data changes that whole trend line. So a big fluctuation, you know, can result in pretty major changes over a 30-year period. But the whole process, the way we do it, usually it kind of presumes that recent trends will kind of hold true through 2040. That's not necessarily a given, but that's just an assumption that we build into the analysis. And we only really intervene in the most extreme cases. We wanted to allow the data to just kind of paint the picture for the future. But there were times where a community would have a negative population, you know, like 2040, or there would be like 90% loss of employment. Certain things just kind of, because of the nature, just were not reasonable. So we kind of used our best judgment and a lot of times other data sources to try to smooth those out. And just one important thing to realize is that this is primarily for the traffic model. It gives us a general outlook, and sometimes, you know, it's kind of debatable whether things will really play out that way. But we want to give people comfort that no real planning decisions, project decisions, are not made so much on this future data. That would be contrary to our fix-it-first philosophy. It gives us an idea of where we may be going and maybe areas to watch for either growth or decline. But we really are concerned with, you know, largely fixing a lot of the problems we have now. So it shouldn't necessarily have a real bleak look for anyone who, you know, maybe it's showing a little bit of decline or something. So anyway, some of the key results, we do these at a very small scale, but at the small scale, they're not incredibly accurate because some of the we do traffic analysis levels in census tracts. Well, some of those cross municipal boundaries, and it's really hard to allocate those between communities and everything. So the moral of the story is these numbers are the most accurate. I think they paint the best picture at the larger 30,000-foot scale. So when you look at it as an entire region, through 2040, we've kind of estimated that the population should continue to slightly decline, -3.8% over the 30-year period, whereas employment, we're kind of anticipating moderate increases over the same period. And the county levels really mirror those trends. Slight population decline over the long term, but employment growth as well. And in Portage County particularly, it showed stronger potential for future growth given recent trends. So as part of the smoothing process, we analyzed this stuff at a really small scale, and then we aggregate it into what were sub-areas. We do pull out a couple of the bigger cities, Barberton, Cuyahoga Falls, and Akron, of course, in the AMATS region. Everything else we kind of group into divide Summit County into thirds and Portage County into quarters, and the Wayne portion has its own. We refer to these as sub-areas. And what it does, it just lumps together geographically similar and proximal locations. And the results are a little better at that scale than if you're looking at kind of the detailed level. So just a couple of the highlights of all those variables, the two that are probably most interesting to most people are the population. So this kind of shows the changes we're expecting through 2040, the strongest population growth being in northern Summit County, northwest Portage is growing about, we expect, averaging 5% over the 2040 period. Those are the areas we kind of watch the most in our long-term planning efforts. And every one of these are detailed at each sub-area and in the communities and counties within tables in the analysis there. And the employment looks a little better. There's a lot of growth we're anticipating, especially in Portage County, kind of throughout there. So this is Southern Summit County had the strongest employment outlook for any place. I believe it was around almost expecting a 50% increase over the 30-year period. So regarding the next steps, we are recommending approval of the document. And once approved, we will load that data into the traffic model, and we continue to work with ODOT to smooth things out and make sure everything looks reasonable and everything. And we use some of this data to inform the upcoming planning process for Transportation Outlook 2040. These data kind of inform us for a lot of the little sub-plans that we work on and eventually the larger plans. So that's pretty much it for the planning data forecast. I'd be happy to answer any questions that anyone may have about it.
Thanks, Nate.
Just looking at the regional one, the bigger problem with the same question is in Portage, but on the regional one, you show a loss by 2040 of workers of 16,000, but then you show total employment increasing by 43,000. And how does that work?
Let's see here. That was at the...
That's the total AMATS area.
Total AMATS area? Well, some of it... We're using independent sources. I mean, it all goes down to census data, but the population is just kind of disconnected from the employment in a way because of those the constraints we have to conform to those Ohio forecasts. Those same constraints don't apply to the employment ones. So that could explain part of it. I don't know if that.
Well, Nate, maybe I'll take a stab and then have a suggestion. Some of that, Doug, could be, I think when we've done similar forecasts, we'll predict sometimes like our population will go down, like in this case, but we'll have employment go up because we assume more people are coming into these two counties from other counties. But it does kind of concern me too, that because I think if from what you said, it's not just people, but it's actual workers, because that's been another social trend. The population's getting older, so even with the same amount of people or even less people, you can have more workers because people are working longer. There's more adults, less kids. But the fact the forecast shows workers going down too is a little bit concerning. And Nate's explanation is true that they're independent variables, but I'm thinking maybe we need to somehow account for that, and because it just doesn't look right. You know, to have, I would definitely say we couldn't, I wouldn't think we could possibly bring in that many commuters from Medina County and Stark County, and et cetera.
It's true. We've got to change our traffic.
Yeah, forecast. We don't want that much, that much commuting.
I don't know if they're trying to come up with 77, but people are either going to somewhere in Summit County or Cuyahoga County.
I suspect what we might be able to do is try to rectify the two somehow, and maybe what we'll have to do is just make an assumption on which one's correct, which would probably be the population, right, Nate, since we're kind of under the...
Yeah, that one definitely has the most accurate historic data sources. Some of the sub-variable workers are one of the ones that we just don't use as much, and there's some pretty lofty assumptions built into that. And it's loosely tied to the population, but there's some various iterations we have to go through, so the methodology...
Yeah, and we're also under that requirement where we have to follow the population control total. So, and I had a question related to that, Nate. Did the employment have a similar control total, or did we just kind of extrapolate and that's what we...
Yeah, we just extrapolated, and there were a couple different methodologies used, and some of them looked more reasonable than others, and there was a little more input from AMATS on that, selecting which looked the better of the two. Sometimes it was a no-brainer, like you would have really just unreasonable-looking employment for 2040, and out of the two scenarios, we'd pick the best one. And we intervened a little bit, you know, when there were a lot of things. But,
So maybe what we need to do is extrapolate on an even more modest curve, so our total employment would come down even more to be closer to matching that amount of workers. I guess the question would be, how much would it have to come down? I'm not asking you that, Doug. We'll figure that out and bring it. But we probably, I mean, that's a big enough, unless you want to help. But that's a big, I think that is a big enough disconnect that we might want to continue, you know, consider having today be more for information and look at approving it at the next meeting.
Absolutely.
Good question.
So it is on our agenda for consideration for approval. Do we have a motion to table it until next meeting? Motion, second from Dave White. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. The motion is,
issue is tabled. For like a question too.
Was there any other question?
I had a question about how much slides would be available for viewing.
What was that again?
The slides you presented,
yeah.
Would that be available someplace for us to view? I
could certainly insert them into the analysis as well. Yeah, we just put that together.
Let's put it on the website too, Nate, if it's not already there. We can put this PowerPoint up, and then Nate will, we'll send the whole committee the link to it so you guys can look through it.
All right. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you.
Now we have the draft road diet analysis for discussion only. Jeff?
5C in your mail, which is the road diet analysis. The most common road diet used for purposes of safety and capacity improvement is to go from a 4-through-lane road to a 3-lane road, which would be 1 through lane each direction with a centered turn lane. A road diet provides additional space for bike lanes and pedestrian islands, bus stops, or on-street parking based on the area's need. And it integrates multiple modes of travel and complete streets design. It provides flexible design that can be tailored to areas such as a central business district or more suburban locations depending on your need. The benefits to a road diet include improved safety due to reduced crashes and severity of crashes by lessening the speeding and weaving on a roadway, improved mobility due to reduced delay times, improved emergency access through the center turn lane, and a road diet also accommodates multiple modes of travel, bicycling, and pedestrian movements through the area, and it promotes complete streets and aesthetics, as well as improving air quality. This is the classic road diet conversion from 4 lanes to 3 lanes. You'll see that the overall roadway width stays the same at 44 feet. On the left, you have, before the conversion to the road diet, 2 through lanes in each direction. After the road diet, you have 1 through lane in each direction, with bike lanes on either side, and you have a center turn lane, a two-way turn lane in the middle. Based on the area's need, you may or may not need bike lanes on either side. It would depend on what your needs were. This project could be easily accomplished as restriping as part of a paving project at little additional cost. Here's a photograph of a before and after conversion to a road diet. We go from 4 lanes to 3 lanes with a center turn lane. This is on a more suburban or rural location. Here is an urban or central business district design conversion to a road diet. In this case, you'll see on-street parking available on both sides, and then you see the bike lanes on either side. This is Copley Road in the city of Akron. It was recently converted to a road diet last year. This is Copley Road, a 1.1-mile stretch on the west side of Akron, between I-77 and downtown Akron. This was implemented as part of a repaving project and has seen reduced speeding, crash rates, and is now safer for pedestrians to cross. In this diagram, you'll see the before road diet on the left and the road diet on the right. The conflict points are as a result of turning movements or cross streets. So each conflict point that you see in the diagram is an opportunity for some type of crash to occur or some other conflict to occur. With the conversion to a road diet on the right, you have improved sight lines for those turning left. Those turning left, of course, in the center turn lane would only have to cross one lane of traffic. So if there were 2 lanes of traffic, you may not see the person in the outside lane, and that problem is eliminated in the, on the right-hand side there after the conversion to the road diet. The table that you see here is on page 1 of attachment 5C. It's just the top 10 candidates. The full table of road diet candidates is included in your report. What we did here was take the 4-lane roads in the AMATS area and look at ADT and a number of other factors. These Tier 1 segments all have an ADT, an average daily traffic, of less than 10,000 a day. The purpose of the AMATS road diet analysis is to provide additional locations, other than the Copley Road example that we just saw, for AMATS members to consider when making improvements in their communities. And we're providing this draft
puts to you for your consideration. The best candidates for a roadway consist of four-lane roads with an average daily traffic less than 10,000, but road diets have been done on roadways greater than 10,000. The Federal Highway Administration recommends not going higher than 20,000 ADT. Other factors to consider when deciding on a road diet are the land use patterns in the area, traffic level of service, driveway and cross street locations, the uses of multiple modes of travel in the area, the use of how much bicyclists are in the area and what kind of pedestrian crossings are needed, as well as community support. You can't implement a road diet if no one in the community wants the road diet, so it's for your consideration. If it's strongly supported in the area, as a one copy road has been supported by the residents in the area, then it's up to you and your community to decide how you wish to implement that. Road diets have been used successfully in many locations due to low cost, reduced crash rates, reduced delays, its ability to integrate multiple modes of travel. It's been successfully implemented across the country and is endorsed by the Federal Highway Administration as a safety measure. And the staff is asking you to consider the road diet as an endorsed safety and development project type for the area. And the staff will seek final approval and endorsement of the road diet concept at the May Tapping Policy meeting. Are there any questions?
None of these on there, Kemmer Boulevard from East Avenue to Lakeshore. Maybe they can put an electric trolley down the middle of that.
Well, we included all the roadways that met the criteria, and it was just a four-lane road with an ADT less than 10,000. Obviously, as we discuss, or you consider all the other factors to consider in a road diet, then there you may just easily eliminate several segments. But
Dave, with you bringing that up, we have been talking about working on a bike plan that we stole this idea from Cleveland, so we didn't come up with it, but that would look at where the old interurbans and trolleys went, and maybe on some of those roads might be candidates on the road diet list, some might not be, but trying to get better bike infrastructure in those corridors and maybe working even with foundations to do something artistic or, you know,
kind of an extension of the trail.
Yeah, and almost have like a historic value. I was just going to add two things to what Jeff said. As he said, this is recommendations. I think when we've talked to both members and others in other regions that have done road diets, sometimes the public, as you can imagine, especially was this way with a lot of roundabouts, at first the typical reaction does tend to be, you know, why are you taking away our lanes? But I think I would encourage members, while the public input is obviously important, what happens over time in a lot of communities, especially roads that truly don't really need those four lanes, is people do get accustomed to it. They realize that it does feel safer once they're driving on it. There's always a trade-off. You might be stopped at the intersection a little bit longer, but have an easier time driving in the mid-block locations because you don't have people turning left from that inside fourth lane and third and fourth lane on the inside. You've got the median turn lane. The other thought, just for everybody's consideration, was we also think, and we'll probably have this in the more detailed report, that if you do have a road where speed enforcement's been an ongoing problem and it doesn't necessarily need those lanes, narrowing it down, you will end up forcing people more to drive the speed limit, because typical road diet on a road that can afford to have one is you're not talking about people not driving 35 anymore. You're talking about them not driving 50 or 55 anymore. And a lot of communities have found it's a lot more cost effective to enforce speed that way, you know, to keep people driving slower that way rather than paying officers to patrol. So just two other thoughts on how they can be helpful.
Yeah, a couple questions, Jeff. And I apologize if you said this before, but do you know the ADTs for the Copley and the South Main Street projects approximately?
since there was already, we didn't include it in the table, since it was already converted to.
Copley was between 10 and 12,000 a day, I think, off the top of my head.
That sounds right.
South Main Street was about 12,000.
Thank you, Bill. And then the other question I have is, in your research, if you have a road that has buses, whether they're regional or school buses, how can those be incorporated into this? Because obviously there's a time where a single lane is going nowhere.
Federal Highway had some, pre-designs, and there are a number of different designs that people have used across the country to incorporate the bus stops. Some use the extended sidewalk for bus stop. There are pedestrian refuge islands, like the bubble that sticks out for bus stops. There are a number of different ways.
And I should let Chris answer this more specifically, but the Copley Road, I think, is Metro's third busiest route in the system, and I think from, I grew up right where that picture is, so I'm both familiar with that area. Typically people just pass the bus in the median turn lane, and I don't think it's ended up being really any more of an issue than just going by the bus, having that that fourth lane, but maybe, I don't know if Chris has more insight.
Right, Jason. I think there was some real initial concern because our operators were used to making good time in the four-lane section, just like everybody else did. Obviously, it constrained the bus's ability to make up time if they're running behind. But I would say, aside from the initial negative reception, it's worked out just fine for us. I would say the concern I had was more about conflict between bike lane and the bus, because they tend to have a similar average operating speed, and if you have a bike and a bus that are kind of side by side, then you know we have to kind of encourage the operator to let the bike get ahead of him a bit when he's going to stop, so that he doesn't have to keep playing hopscotch with the bike. But realistically, my sense is that it's operating very well, and I think pedestrians trying to get to our bus stops have a much easier time crossing the middle turn lane than they did before. So I think it's a really big benefit.
Any other questions, comments? I had a question about whether there's any impact that we know of on maintenance costs over time. You've got two fewer lanes that are going to have constant road traffic on it. If you're taking that, some of that space and putting it into bike lanes and a turn lane.
I didn't see any data on maintenance costs.
The biggest cost of maintenance is going to be snow removal. So it's going to take the same number of passes to clear 44 feet, whether it's a three-lane or a two-lane or four-lane. Crack seal is going to be done. That's the next major cost. Resurfacing gets down to the question, do I resurface the shoulders and save 4 feet, or question, resurface all the way up to the edge? Other than that, some initial cost with revised siding. Some initial cost with a little less striping. But it's going to be about the same with or without, whichever way you're going.
And I think the only exception would be, and that's not really what these are recommended as generally, but if a community did a true pavement reduction road diet as part of a reconstruction, I mean, there you'd have to weigh the upfront cost of all the extra cost you'd entail to actually shrink that road down. But over time, you would be saving money. Like Joe said, you wouldn't have to plow as many lanes and resurface as many lanes. But I think for planning purposes right now, most of the ones we're recommending are not, we don't necessarily have a design treatment specified. It's more this is a candidate, and then the local community could kind of decide what design makes sense.
All right. If there's no other comments or questions, thanks, Jeff. Next on the agenda, Metro RTA Transit Development Plan. Chris?
Well, I appreciate this opportunity to come and talk to you about our metro projects and what we've got coming up. I've got to acknowledge, we really have a full agenda today, so I'm going to try and talk
pretty briefly about half a dozen projects that we're working on, and try to spend most of the time talking about these projects with just a brief overview of Metro. So, first of all, about the money, I mean, we are sales tax funded, and so the focus of our operations really is on Summit County and trying to benefit our taxpayers. We operate 39 fixed routes with published schedules, including urban, suburban, weekday grocery buses, and a couple of express routes up to Cleveland. We also operate with the smaller of the buses shown up there, SCAT ADA dial ride service for elderly and disabled residents. And so we carry about 17,000 passengers on weekday. That's was our average from last year, and I would say we're pretty much on pace to replicate that or maybe do a little better than that this year, with the possible exception of last month, which was really a problem, I think, due to weather, slippery conditions, all kinds of other things. Most of Summit County residents live within walking distance of a bus stop, convenient walking distance, and we're really striving to make sure that transit continues to be a viable and affordable option for most of the people in Summit County, wherever they live. And I think based on some of the maps that were being shown earlier about where population is growing and declining, it's safe to say that the core of our service area continues to see population decline, and the suburban areas where our fixed routes are not as robust is where most of the population growth is happening, which is a real challenge for us to keep up with. So these six projects are ones that I want to talk briefly about, and I'm going to cover each of them individually, so I'm just going to move right along. Last fall, we cooperated with the city of Akron to build a new park and ride lot just south of our downtown transit center. And it's not quite done yet. It is open for use. We still have to install the landscaping and signage and things like that. And that'll be done this spring. So if you want to catch a bus from the transit center to some outlying location that we serve, including up to Cleveland, this is a place you can leave your car and get on with your travel. We also rebuilt Rosa Parks Drive. You may have noticed that between Broadway and South Main Street. And that provides a new pedestrian connection, really, from the transit center over to the south end of downtown, which wasn't really there before. People were essentially pounding dirt paths to get over to the transit center. So we think that's a big improvement. The zip card is a demonstration agreement that we put together last year with the University of Akron. They prepaid Metro to allow their students and staff to essentially use their ID cards in our fare boxes. And since then, we've watched the university-related ridership grow by more than half, and we're hoping to continue this program into the 2015-2016 academic year, and also to partner with other institutions of higher learning to replicate that model and grow student ridership throughout the county. This just shows really what a smart card-enabled fare box report can deliver. This is just a single page of the monthly report that we provide to the university. It shows on any given day or date on the bottom in red the number of individual card users that use that card for travel that day. And the little line in blue that has the peaks and valleys shows the number of actual boardings on a bus. So obviously each card is used multiple times. Like the average is about 2.2 trips a day or something like that. And then in the purple line on the top, we showed a cumulative number of unique passes used during that month. So on a monthly basis, we see about 1,000 cards being used. On any given day, it's more like 400 to 500. But we think it's a trend, and we hope to be able to do more of it. This is a slide from our marketing campaign for Call of Us. This is a program that we started in North Summit County in 2013. And last year, this was done as a demonstration, really to try and serve this low-density area where we had relatively poor route coverage. Last year, we surveyed the users that were taking advantage of it, and as a result, we expanded both the hours of service and the geographic area that we serve. And as a result, we have really high customer satisfaction levels, and usage of this program has also grown considerably, just about doubled last year from the year before. So in 2015, we're really looking to kind of apply this model in additional areas, and probably in South Summit County as our next target. So this is a real exciting project that ought to be exciting. It's costing us about $3 million. But essentially what we're implementing is an automatic vehicle location system that essentially equips every vehicle in our fleet with a GPS unit that really allows that our dispatchers will always be in contact with all of our vehicles. They'll know where they are, whether they're on schedule, and how many people they have on the bus. So all those things tell you a little bit about the features that it has. It will have automatic passenger counters on all the doors. It will have on-vehicle stop announcements that are enabled by the vehicle schedule, by the route schedule. And it also enables real-time schedule information for our customers. So our customers will be able to find out exactly when the next bus will arrive at their specific stop. In order to enable the system, and all the power that it offers, we are going to replace all of our bus stop signs. So this is a rebranding opportunity. We have, on the nature of 2,400 bus stop signs all over the county, and we are going to have to replace all of them. So unfortunately, right now, they're located on telephone poles, light standards, other street signs, and a minority of them are actually on our own post. We're in the process of selecting a contractor to replace all the signs and to purchase all the parts to make that happen. We're hoping that we'll be able to get that done in 2015. And part of this is that each sign will have the unique bus stop identifier number on it so that anybody with a handheld device can enter that stop number and find out when the next bus is going to be there. Also, as you can see, it will include the routes serving each stop, which right now is not something that we provide for our users. About a week or so ago, our planning department sent out a copy of a transit design guide to all our Summit County jurisdictions. This report was created in-house in order to try to spell out our design parameters for bus stops, shelters, benches, and other transit facilities. And we're inviting input from all reviewers, in part because we really want to partner with all of you to try and figure out how to make transit better here in Summit County. And, of course, some of the things included there include just trying to communicate that buses are big. Oftentimes, we need to explain that in terms that people can understand so they know what they can or can't do some things with them. We often get requested to go off route into properties, for example, which is pretty hard to do with a 40 or 60-foot bus. We also then are including some of the standards for our standard bus stops and shelters to really communicate our spatial needs for street design projects and also for our own stop improvements. And as I mentioned, we've got quite a few of those queued up. So when we work with local jurisdictions to try and review those projects, we can communicate a little better what our needs are. We're working on a downtown circulator for the city of Akron, for the downtown area, and we've been paying close attention to other successful circulator models in Columbus and Cleveland, and we're trying to apply lessons learned from some of those other services. We have a draft routing plan that's shown here. This is a little hard to see on this slide, but essentially it's two loops of about 3 miles each in blue and green, operating on Broadway, Main and High Streets with a frequent 10-minute type headway so that you could use transit to get to daytime meetings or for lunch at Luigi's, for example, without having to get in your car and circle the block to look for a parking space. Combined with the park and ride lot south of the transit center, we think we can offer transit really as a viable option to reduce some of the congestion that occurs with baseball games and other special events downtown. And in order to make this a successful endeavor, we're also seeking subsidies from the city and other downtown interests to help make that happen. And with that, you know, if there are some questions that we could...
Do you have any way to determine how much impact the 50 has done on, is there any reduction of traffic that has to circulate in the
In Montrose? I would say that the Montrose circulator is more frequent than the ridership warrants, and we will be considering some service frequency reductions there in the coming year. It does do a lot of good to extend the service area from the end of the Route 1. And, you know, a lot of people that have destinations west or north of the freeway end up using the circulator to get out there. But I would say that we're giving it more than it's returning in the way of ridership and revenue. But it's been a huge benefit to that area.
Your comment about the central Akron circulator made the people to get to and from lunch and that type of thing, is that something that could be promoted more in Montrose area? Are people going to lunch that might say...
That's a fair question. I would say that we don't typically market the individual routes as much as we probably could, except when we're launching them. And that's something to think about there. I know there is a lot of lunchtime congestion, especially up on the hill. Yeah, Jason.
Hey, Chris, I just wanted to applaud you guys for the AVL real-time information project, because although I know it's expensive, as someone who rides occasionally and my wife rides every day, it's really valuable to know exactly when that bus is coming. I mean, you guys are never early, which is great, because that's the last thing that you want, because then you miss the bus for sure. But it is nice for those, you know, running an errand and knowing, hey, I still have 7 minutes to get this cup of coffee or whatever it is. And I think from a lot of the trends we're reading about with younger people that are more interested in not having to drive everywhere. That project really makes sense for growing ridership because they're going to definitely be expecting to be able to look at their smartphone and know exactly when the bus is coming. So I think you guys are right on that. I know other transit agencies have done it, but you're not on the bleeding edge. You're probably more on the cutting edge.
Yeah, this is probably an area where we're really trying to catch up because there are a lot of jurisdictions who have implemented this kind of a system in our region. SARTA has AVL, has for a little while now, and we're trying to catch up. The other thing I'll say about it is that it's a lot more complicated than I thought it was. All the different scheduling details that have to be imported to be downloadable to every individual bus, it gets to be a real number-crunching challenge. But we're already seeing data coming back from the passenger counters and other things, so I'm really excited about the prospects for our ability to manage more by numbers and not by sort of the art, anecdotal observation, I guess, is what it often ends up being.
Okay. Any other comments?
Will people be able to sign up sometime to have to send an alarm to their device to wake them up in time to get the bus?
Absolutely. There are apps, phone apps, that you can set up in advance so that, every afternoon starting at 4 o'clock, you can have your phone start telling you when the next bus is going to be there. I mean, there are a lot of things that would allow you to wait to leave your desk until 2 minutes before you know it's going to be there. Pretty cool. Well, thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Okay, next item under resolutions, resolution 2015-05, supporting an increase in the federal gasoline tax. Jason.
Okay, thanks, Ms. Chair. Attachment 6A is, Chris mentioned, it's a resolution that does two things, supporting an increase in the federal gasoline tax as well as a new federal and statewide transportation policy framework. So just a little bit of background. You might recall last summer, I think it was, the staff wrote a letter on behalf of the policy committee to our congressional delegation about this issue, and then at the last meeting it was recommended that we put together a resolution for your consideration. So I won't go through this whole memo, it's pretty long, but just to hit the high points. The two things the memo talks about are the fiscal position, specifically that the Highway Trust Fund is in. So just a couple real quick background points. It hasn't – the gas tax, the federal gasoline tax, hasn't been increased since 1993. It was 18.4 cents a gallon then. It's 18.4 cents a gallon now. As you can imagine, with the country growing, with inflation – there have been other trends like people driving less, which has eroded its ability, but it's fair to say it hasn't kept up with the modern realities of funding a transportation system. So where that's been manifested the most and the most obviously is the trust fund has borrowed $55 billion over the last couple years from the general fund, which the general fund is really borrowed money because we have a $17 trillion national debt. So what that means is it's just not paying for itself anymore. There's no conceivable scenario in the future where it will pay for itself. So as we've reported many times at these meetings, Congress has had these discussions about what to do, and the long story short is no one's come up with an exact plan of attack. There have been different ideas about different kinds of taxes or continuing to borrow the money, but we don't think as a staff that's sustainable. When we look at it, the only short-term fix we see for it is to raise the gasoline tax. But we also feel like we don't want to just, quote, throw more money at the problem. We also feel like there could be a new policy framework at the state and the federal level, especially for how that money is spent. So that's the second thing that the memo does is it talks a little bit about you know, what the policy framework and what we try to do is draw the distinction that with our own funding here at AMETS, for example, both our plan and our TIP and our funding policy reflect two main things we've done. One of those is to emphasize more of a fix-it-first approach of fixing the infrastructure we have before adding new capacity. And then the second thing is to try to focus on more modest improvements to public transit and bike and pedestrian infrastructure. And at least at the local level or the regional level, I should say, that hasn't necessarily entailed a lot more expenditure, but it's been raising awareness about it, coming up with innovative projects like some of this stuff Chris was even just reporting on, with ways to make transit friendlier to people and et cetera. So what we kind of felt like from the state and federal level, I'll just kind of go through what basically is recommended here, and then I'll turn it back to the chair and open it up for discussion. And I should give the caveat, as you can probably imagine, this is the staff's recommendation. As committee members, we want to tee this up to you as a starting point. You can feel free to tweak it, reword things, have us go in a different direction, but this is our first crack at it. So what we recommend here is first that the policy committee endorse a 10-cent per gallon increase in the federal gasoline tax. From the Ohio side, this resolution recommends that Ohio continue to pursue a lot of the innovative practices that the state has been doing. That could include looking at tolling, for example, on the Brent Spence Bridge in Cincinnati that connects Cincinnati to Kentucky. That bridge is going to be tolled to help pay for the cost of that. And also, as you're aware, the Ohio Turnpike and Infrastructure Commission was formed recently to help fund projects through other sources other than just relying on state or federal gas taxes. The Ohio gas tax, it was increased in 2005. It's 28 cents a gallon. We're recommending here that it be kind of monitored or reexamined, but I know personally at this time ODOT, you know, that was an issue in the budget hearings, that there wasn't an interest in increasing it. We kind of think that with some innovation and maybe increasing the federal gas tax, the staff isn't convinced we would need to raise the state gas tax, but it would be worth reexamining in the future. From a policy side, then, what this kind of recommends is just that USDOT, both with how its funding categories are put together and ODOT with how its funds are spent, that both levels of government, federal and state, we emphasize even more prioritizing maintenance over adding capacity. That doesn't mean that we're saying that a road should never get a capacity addition, but when we look at how much in debt we are with infrastructure, especially more here in Ohio, with us being the 44th fastest growing state, or sixth slowest growing state, however you want to say that, we feel like we do have some ability. You know, in this region specifically, you saw the planning data forecast, but at the state, we don't necessarily have to play catch up with a ton of congestion. So that might be another opportunity actually to save some money. And then also, as I said earlier, recommends that where we can, we try to put money into some of the less expensive projects that might make it easier to not have to drive. So that's basically what the resolution says and does. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I know there'll probably be a lot of interest or discussion about it, but at this point I'll turn it back over to Chris and start the discussion.
I'll ask the first question. How was a 10-cent amount determined? Is this something that other transportation agencies across the country, is there general consensus on this?
That's a great question. That number wasn't pulled out of thin air. So back in 2010, the policy committee did pass, and I should have mentioned that, we did pass here a resolution endorsing a 10-cent increase. At that time, and in continuing in today, there have been a couple of congressmen or senators that have recommended something more than 10 cents. There have been some groups that have recommended a little bit less, but when we look at all the different numbers that are out there, that's been kind of a midpoint of what people have recommended. And then financially, what that gets us is generally each penny is between $1.5 and $2 billion. So if it were raised 10 cents, we're talking around $20 to $30 billion, most likely. So that does give, about $20 billion, not 30. But that $20 billion, that makes up pretty much all the shortfall of that money that we're borrowing. You know, the trust fund every year is around $7 to $8 billion short.
Joe?
That doesn't put any money for the non-federally eligible roadways, which are the vast majority of our problems. It doesn't do those side roads. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't do the vast majority of city streets. We need some relaxation of the federally eligible requirements. You said 10 cents, I'd go with 10 cents for the federally eligible ones. I'd like to see another nickel or gallon for all roadways. That way we can use on anything from an alley on up. But we just don't have enough cash available to do the work that we need to have done. We're constrained by our own budget systems. They want to see a five-year budget that's balanced. And the same thing that Victor has to go through, we have to go through, but out in the out years, I got a laundry list of projects that are just dying out there. Bridges are rated on a structural sufficiency rating. My worst bridge is an 18, and I don't have money. On a scale of 1 to 100, it's an 18. And I don't have money.
So that would be one of those policy changes?
That's one of those policy changes. I'd like to see some money, a chunk of money that is one tied to non-federal eligible roadways, which would be what we're getting from the license plate fees right now. The second thing is we need greater flexibility. We need money that will grow, that we don't have to come back here in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years and ask for another cents per gallon. We need something that's inflation adjusted. The average consumer price index has gone up 2 to 2.5% per year for the past 15 years. In the construction industry, it's 6 and 7% per year for the past 12 years. The money it's not being allocated where it's needed. Now we're doing borrowing from somebody, which means we're paying interest on it. ODOT's doing a great deal right now, bringing money forward, selling bonds. Those bonds can be paid off. We're just borrowing the next governor's money from our own highway program.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
We're just shoveling it deeper. We can't get out of the hole by digging deeper. Unfortunately, I have to go to another meeting, so I'll excuse myself.
Thanks, Joe.
Okay, now we talk about Joe.
We'll talk about
you. I'm in general support with what they said. I'd like to put it on the table so that we've got an issue to discuss. And I think this is excellent. It's been excellent since you guys did this earlier when you proposed the 10 cents increase. You've given a really good background and history on this. And Mr. Paradise has mentioned something that's obvious, I think, to everybody, is that local roads are filled with potholes and nobody can fill them. Mm-hmm. And especially the little community I live in, Brady Lake. I mean, it's like going over the moon. It's just crazy. And anyway, I'd like to move that we do adopt this resolution and that we add to it what Mr. Paradise is referring to is an additional 5 cents federal tax that would go exclusively to local communities for their road improvements and repairs. So that's sticking with the user pay standard. We're asking for 10% increase. We're asking for policy changes so that there'll be more of an emphasis on fix it first, as this report states, and we're also suggesting changes in priorities, especially in Ohio, so that we can have, we're talking about a transportation system, not just a highway system, and you propose to have some a shift of priorities where hike and bike gets more funds, and that encourages people to use the highway system less. It's all good stuff, and this is the kind of thing that I love to see. I hate to see tax increases, but user pay tax increases are necessary.
I'll second what he's saying.
Okay, so...
made a motion with an amendment, right?
I made a motion where I suggest we amend the resolution so that it does include the 5 cents increase per gallon for, but earmarking is strictly for local roads.
Okay, good. And I wrote three things down, Doug, so I'll play them back. And what I was going to suggest, and this would hold true, I think, for other suggestions, if it's amenable to the committee, I think we'll try to capture it and play it back here, and then we'll rewrite the resolution for the policy committee to reflect that, just so we don't get, you know, wordsmithing every single word here. But the three things I heard was, so 15 cents for the federal gas tax, but have language in there that's clear about 10 cents for the program as it can currently exists, but 5 cents that would be earmarked specifically for local governments for maintenance or something along those lines, if I got that.
Yes, and then transportation systems.
Okay, great. And then did your motion also include Joe's talk about inflation, saying that the tax should be adjusted for inflation?
I did not include that.
Okay.
Because that is really controversial. I didn't want to mess it up.
Hold on. let's let Jason finish with the
report. I think that was all I had for the, if that was what you...
Yeah, I was making motion.
Okay.
Along the lines you just summarized.
Okay, so we had a motion, and Dave seconded that motion the way it was with Chris.
On the discussion, I would just add that from the transportation user's perspective, the fact that the ADA Act was passed in 1990 has in very little way accomplished barrier-free transportation for people with disabilities. And too often, it's overlooked until it's time to do a roadway project when you have to do the curb ramps, which adds considerably to a roadway project budget. And retrofitting an existing street, even during the repaving project, which is what's supposed to be done, bringing up the same standards, adding curb ramps at all the intersections and all that stuff is a pretty costly thing. I guess I'm just making that point because I think it helps bolster the argument for the extra 5% as well as the 10%. It's all those, all that infrastructure from property line to property line is supposed to be brought up for use for everyone. And I think that's part of what.
So perhaps that could be included as an additional whereas clause in the resolution, acknowledging the need for more ADA compliance. Amy?
I have a concern with the means and methods of taking that 5% for local roads. Why we'd be looking at the federal, putting in the federal pot of money. The federal pot of money comes with a lot of strings, which costs a lot more to actually get to the point of putting the pavement on the ground. There's a lot more upfront studies, a lot of things you have to do associated with that federal money. If we're really looking at it as a state issue or a statewide issue, and I know the current administration tax, increasing taxes isn't there, but there's other pots of money. We talk about registration, license plate registration is making those dollars. Is that the better place to do it that actually goes back to the locals without a whole bunch of strings attached to how you spend that money to resurface your road or fix your road? You don't get into the whole...
And as I recall, some of that was in previous discussion, too, looking at all of the ways of capturing some additional highway funding.
And right now, we're not a donor state. We used to be a donor state at the federal level. With population trends moving and no growth in the state of Ohio, are we always going to be a non-donor? Are we always going to get back what we put in, or are we going to end up being a donor state again?
I mean, that's a good question that I can't really answer, just because the donor-donee tends to slip depending on exactly how Congress writes the bill. But the long-term outlook for the state's population and influence is definitely not great. You know, we've lost, I think, 4 congressional reps since I started at AMATS, and we lost 2 in the last census. And so to your point, I mean, our ability to kind of lobby for things that help Ohio at the federal level is probably not getting stronger.
And I don't know, the 10% makes sense on a national level. It's a 10 cents, covers the deficit and the cost of the structure there. But I think addressing those more local needs shouldn't have to go to a federal and back with those stipulations. Maybe we should be petitioning other agencies that control those funds that actually get back to the state. I know even Joe's left, but to get money from permissive tax, there's only about six roads in my city that I can even though I've got a pot of money sitting there in permissive tax, I can't get that money to do a road that's not on that list, that may be a road that's not actually a local street, but a good connector street that pulls a lot of the subdivisions out. I have no access to the money because of the policies that sit there as well. And, you know, I might have money sitting there, just not able to use it until I get to the point of implementing on one of those six roads.
Jeff?
Thanks, Chris. I guess I would strongly agree with Amy. Having federal gas tax to fund local streets adds regulations and oversight that are unnecessary in us doing a local street. It typically adds 25 to 30% of our project cost, and our dollars will go less far. Especially, and I agree with Amy, I really don't want to see local Ohio tax paying to do roads out in California. I do think if we want to add to address the local issue, that's more of a request to the state or even our own local municipalities. Barberton, my understanding, passed a tax recently to do roads. Ravenna is looking to do the same thing. It's a local issue. And if you have local funds or state funds, you can get much more done with the same amount of money. We don't need the oversight to get this problem solved. So.
Any other discussion?
I would ditto Amy and Jim on the tax issue about the one state of Ohio tax or something, so we can use all the local streets, not asking. But I also have an issue with some of the words in here about more, wider, more expensive streets that we don't want to, we want them to discourage that. I have a little issue with that because I think one, it's ambiguous, and two, there sometimes is a need for, your words, more, wider, more expensive streets. So I agree with encouraging maintenance of existing roadways, but I do think there's a need at times for improved capacity on streets, which may become wider streets.
And I'm trying to remember, Wayne, was that resolution language or was that more in the memo?
One's on page 2.
Okay.
Agree, and then one is actually, I think, part of the resolution, whereas prior to by organizing roadway maintenance over highway expansion. I guess the word highway expansion needs to be defined as well. But in the memo, we talk about more wide. I'm not saying, I understand that's part of the memo, but
right.
It also kind of carries over in somewhat of a format as the word highway expansion.
Got it.
I'm very supportive of maintenance. I mean, the resurfacing programs, but I do think there are needs for capacity issues on highways, which end up becoming potentially wider roads.
So, Wayne, is it the prioritizing? Is that the word that's the issue in that?
I think maybe it could be wording it a little bit differently to encourage funding of roadway maintenance, existing roadways. But I don't think we should use their words to be a highway expansion out.
Any other comments?
Well, I think it was just using slightly different words than Wayne, but it almost is saying that let's ignore a capacity issue. Let's let people just suffer. Because I thought the program already kind of addresses that where you have a capacity issue, you get the funding. So what is it really trying to say is that, well, we don't care if there's congestion, we're not going to add capacity? Or what is it? I was trying to imagine in practice, how would that get implemented?
From our standpoint, when I'll kind of just deal with the whereas that said that, so the where it says prioritizing roadway maintenance over highway expansion, Like Wayne said, we purposely did leave that a little ambiguous, but so really to do exactly what Wayne was talking about, where it wouldn't rule out expansion, that's why we said prioritizing it over it, but it doesn't say no federal or state funds should ever be used for highway expansion. I mean, that's unrealistic and would hurt. So we were kind of trying to strike that balance between saying that the federal, and because one of the realities of the federal program is so much of the money, and we saw this in Ohio with the $1 billion from the Turnpike, virtually all went to $450 million went to the bypass around Portsmouth, population 20,000. $350 million going to a new road in Cleveland called the Opportunity Corridor, which is brand new construction. So I'm not here to demonize those projects. I'm just making the point that was almost $1 billion right there that can't be used for maintenance. And when we look at the numbers in a state that's really at our growth rate, which is almost zero, we question how much is it worth it to spend that much money on relieving marginal amounts of congestion. Now, every case is different. There could be another road where the congestion is nightmarish and it should be, the capacity should be increased. So that's why we, I don't know if we pulled that trick off here, but what we were trying to say is it should be discouraged but not ever not be allowed to happen.
You'd have a point system like you do now, where you determine what gets funded based on how many points it gets.
Right. We kind of tried to model what it says on what our own funding policy. Now, granted, that may not work as well for Atlanta, but I'm sure the AMATs won't probably influence, you know, Congress to make policy decisions in Atlanta anyway.
But there's an interesting balance here between road diet and passenger. We're striving for that balance, because there's some places where we've got too much road and we need to narrow it down. But then there's certainly some places where we need more road. So we're looking at a balance. Probably we want to tend to tip that more to the road diet, but we have to look at individual situations that's going to affect it.
Christopher?
I would just say that if you do not tie it to some kind of inflation, just postponing the problem. And I agree that maybe our letter is going to move Congress, but I think we should take a leadership role. A gas tax in itself is controversial. Mm-hmm. If you don't tie it to inflation, you're just postponing this problem another 10, 20 years. So I think that's a critical component that should be.
Okay, any other comments? So the motion we have on the table right now includes the extra 5 cents for the local roads from the federal funding, but no increase for inflation. We could either amend that motion. You want to amend that?
I'd like to ask a question. I would like to amend it if I'm understanding right, and I think I am. Your comments, Amy, and your comments, Jim, and somebody else's comments, I think it was yours, that all we're doing is we're getting expensive local roads, and we really don't need that. Would it solve it if we suggested an extra nickel on the state tax?
My answer would be that's better than asking for federal, an extra nickel from federal.
I think
because that's where
all the red tape.
All the red tape.
Yeah, that's what Amy and Jim's comments were about.
In the state tax, yes and no, I guess, is my answer to that. The easiest money for me to spend is license plates tax, things like that come there and that comes directly to the city with very little strings tied to it. You could pave any one of your roads anywhere in your city using that money. And that's basically the problem that everybody's having is you have so much money, you need to do 10 roads and you can only do 5, and you got potholes that twice as many potholes a year before because you didn't do what you needed to do on the road before. So I think those are the places that you need to petition. And I think that's probably still through the state. There's $20 you can collect right now on a license plate.
Yeah, you guys probably understand
that
this better.
That needs to be upped to a higher amount of money, And I'm not sure the avenue to do that. I just know that's where the easiest money to spend on a local road comes from.
And I'll echo what Amy just said. We're in a similar situation. That permissive money is only eligible for bridges or arterials or certain roads. Our bridges are all replaced. Arterials are in pretty good shape. I'm running out of pavements as well, too. And I don't want to lose that money every year. So that is something that my easiest form of money with no strings attached is public works. But, of course, they don't, you know, resurfacing projects score
very, very poor. Yes.
You might as well need to apply. They're not going to get any funding at all. So maybe that policy could be changed as well, again, at the state level.
And they get more, yeah, that would be the state, as opposed to ODOT, Ohio Public Works, would right. be the element if they have
projects,
more funding.
The projects that we have done, the STP resurfacing projects, have been great. They've allowed us to do long arterials and get an 80% discount, but it takes 5 years, and now maybe even longer. We have, because we're over-programmed, we have to push these projects out even further.
Jim?
I suggest to leave off the federal. Mm-hmm. Leave off the component deal, federal rules, off of this resolution, and make it a different resolution if you want.
You mean for the 5 cent?
Yeah.
It sounds like consensus is kind of leaning that way.
Yes, I think that would be a good amendment. Okay. I'm not sure how we structure it. You know, that additional money should be coming from local, or there should be policy changes. I've worked with the Public Works Fund too. Public Works, and they're reasonable. And there's a mess, you know, that we have to deal with every program. But Ohio is much more reasonable than the feds in terms of red tape. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the people are reasonable, but, you know, they have their job to do as well.
What about the increase for inflation? Do you want to include that in your motion?
I'm not sure what to do about that. So I'd like to just leave that open and, you know, if leave it open for a vote so that it can be either say yay or nay. So I guess I would say yes, let's put it in, but I'm not really sure if that's a good idea to put it in the inflationary thing. But sure, just to put it up for a vote, I'd agree to the change. Let's put the inflationary aspect in there.
Is it contingency clause? Is it such a thing?
I don't know. Just put it in there as something in the resolution you guys supported. You know what we're trying to do.
Yeah,
and drop it from the federal tax and make it either state tax or something that is similar to that. The beauty of the gasoline tax is you're paying it when you're buying your gas. And that stuff fluctuates so much already that an extra nickel is nothing. And I think that the average person would be willing to do that, especially if they're only driving 10, 15,000 miles a year, which is supposedly the average amount of miles.
Well, and if I could make a suggestion and just ask a clarifying question for the wording, I think from the staff perspective, we, with you, wanted to start with the 10 cents, but we too, I think, would recommend putting something about inflation. I mean, it doesn't hurt anything. If the policy committee is willing to vote for it, it makes our resolution a little stronger. From the state perspective, I'll point you to a section of the resolution, but for increasing the state gas tax 5 cents, well, I'm sure Steve himself might be willing to give that to you. I'm not sure if that went to ODOT. There's no guarantee local governments would see any more funding. Plus, I don't think the state is interested in raising the gas tax right now. It does sound to me just like those license fees or doing something like that might be a better avenue. What we did write in here, which is vague, but we didn't want to make this too prescriptive without getting input from all of you like we're doing right now. But what we wrote here is this committee believes that ODOT should continue to pursue innovative and non-traditional sources of revenue, such as the tolling of additional facilities and further partnerships with local governments and with the Ohio Turnpike and Infrastructure Commission. So what we were trying to say there, maybe it's too vague, was that wouldn't preclude anything like the kind of stuff you guys are talking about. New funding sources, doing something different with OPWC, license fees, permissive tax, whatever would help. Now, we could keep it like that if you feel that meets the spirit of what you're discussing, or we could take a crack at another whereas for the policy committee. That might be one we just would like to get a little more guidance on.
Jason, would you be better? You're dealing with the Highway Trust Fund. I mean, that's kind of what I thought it was all about. Why don't you do another resolution relative to the state that you can try to push the issue regarding looking at mechanisms to fund local streets? I mean,
yeah, so you suggest.
I mean, that's you know, ODOT's going to see this, and that, if I was them, I'd say, well, this is all about the Highway Trust Fund. Okay, they're asking for federal tax increases, not us.
You suggested two separate resolutions, right?
That's what I'm suggesting.
I'm sorry, your name?
Mike Teodek, the City of Akron. I think this 10 cents is an overdue short-term solution to a much bigger issue. I think trying to add all of everybody's concern is the reason why it hasn't gone up in the last however many years. I think keeping it simple now and looking at a short-term solution should be a resolution. If we want to suggest many other mechanisms, that's where I was going 5 minutes ago, is I believe it should be a separate resolution if we want to start going into the much bigger picture of all the other things to help solve the long-term solution to it. So I think keep those two items separate would be the best approach. Other than adding in
more travel ODOT than we surely do with the federal highway.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Other than adding in potentially the ability to make inflation adjustments to it or escalation somehow to work that in.
Some sort of increase, not necessarily called inflation.
Yeah, I understand. Some kind of flexibility to it.
Provide for an increase without having to go back.
But the more things we try and complicate it with, the less likely everybody's going to agree on the direction.
So are we back where we started? Or with some wording in there for inflation, is that your motion, Doug?
I think
10 cents?
What I heard is we were still at 15, but also with inflation. Was
it,
that?
You know, all the comments are really good. And I think it is wise for us to just leave it as a 10 cents federal tax. The inflationary aspect, you know, put it in there. And but would the staff come up with another resolution at the next meeting so that we can ask for something along the lines of 5 cents? I mean, something that makes sense. And maybe more than cents, but you know what I mean. The 10 cents per gallon federal tax made sense based on the issues that you brought up earlier. So something like 5 cents for the state of Ohio. And whatever, we need to deal with it, and I'm just suggesting let's try to deal with it, and I'm willing to come up with that resolution and say, you know, I make a resolution along so lines and everything, but it sounds like the state, I really think it is a good idea to not have the extra 5 cents be in federal taxes, so let's just drop that out and just make it 10 cents for the federal tax increase and use the local problem. Let's deal with that at another meeting. And you've got a small group, evidently, to put that resolution together, right?
Mm-hmm.
Put it back before them.
So your motion was basically 10, just we'll keep it at 10 cents. Really, the only change to what's written here is a caveat about adjust it for inflation. We keep the rest of it as it is, and then at another meeting we work on a resolution that deals with some of these more nuanced maybe state and local issues.
Sure.
Would you be willing to agree to second that with comments also?
Okay. Now, any more discussion?
Just quickly, if I remember correctly, back in 2010 when this came up, I thought the committee here deferred any decisions over the policy, and that's where all the discussion happened. I will support the current motion adding in the index, but I just know that the next policy meeting, which is next week, that has all the elected officials, they're going to have as much discussion as we had, they're going to have even more. And so just trying to, I mean, let's let them modify it how they want to. I agree suggesting the index, but everything else, let's keep it simple.
Okay. We're going to try this with a voice vote first. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Same sign?
Here. I respectfully vote.
Okay. Motion carries. Thank you very much. Resolution.
Thank all of you. Really, that was a long discussion.
Resolution 2015-06, approving amendment number 22 to the Transportation Improvement Program. Dave.
Thank you. I was sitting there listening to all the discussion about the gas tax, and I'm just thinking, if we have that much discussion amongst a technical advisory committee, how much will they have at a federal level? You know, it was.
But we got more done.
Okay, resolution 2015-06 is attachment 6B. This is amendment 22 to our current TIP. This will be our last amendment because we are developing a new 2016-19 TIP. This amendment adds two new projects, revises the schedule to two projects, and revises the funding to one project. The two new projects is Boston Mills Road in Boston Township. This is resurfacing and also widening, so there'll be wider shoulders for biking and pedestrians. This will, the construction is scheduled in fiscal year 2017. And the other new project is the State Route 8 Bridge. That's the high-level bridge here in Akron. This is funding just to begin the study of the design and realignment. And that is to begin in fiscal year 2015. The projects that will be revised is Prospect Street in Portage County. Resurfacing and sidewalks will be moved from fiscal year 17 to fiscal year 15. Springdale Road bike lanes in Stowe, construction will be moved from 2016 to 2015, and State Route 91 in Twinsburg. Increased the cost of engineering in fiscal year 2015 from $20,000 to $60,000. If there's any questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them. If not, the staff recommends approval.
Any questions? Do you want
to
make a motion?
Do
you have a second?
Jim Boland, second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, great. Thanks, Commissioner Perry. And does anybody have any other business to bring before the committee? All right, well, with that, do I have a motion to adjourn? Second, John. Very good. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you all.